Welcome to Real Estate Radio Live, an informative and engaging podcast discussing everything you need to know about the world of real estate. Your host, Joe Cacera, provides you with insight and guidance on how to buy, sell, finance, and invest in real estate. He also offers real estate tax management strategies, new construction advice, home improvement tips, and much, much more. And now, to guide you around the world of real estate, here's your host and Real Estate Radio Live team leader, Joe Cacera.
Welcome in, Joe Cacera with Real Estate Radio Live. Thank you for those that are tuning in, watching us on Facebook and social media. We appreciate that very much. As a reminder, we're here in our studio. We do the show, and some of the people watch us live on Facebook. The other ones, this is a podcast, so when we're done with the show, we get it distributed out to thousands and thousands of people each month. So
tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands, that's right. It's getting there, isn't it?
Yes.
We get a lot of 8,000 to 10,000 minimum in each month, and we want to appreciate, thank those that continue to download the show and share the show with others. I appreciate it very much. I hope we're doing something right. It sounds like we are.
Of course. Joe, you're one of the veterans. You taught me how to do podcasting, and I was one of the early people with Bill
Fenwick. Is anybody in your law firm doing it? Or not your firm?
No, they're all in fear. I try to drag them in here. They're like, no, I really don't want to hear myself on radio. I don't have the same voice as you. And, you know, I say this as a true story, and I want to tell the story for a second because we have someone who's near and dear to me because she's near and dear to Bill Fenwick, who's a good friend and was a partner of mine in a previous law firm. And then I left because they were getting too big. That's all about the story. And Bill probably tells it differently, but it would be interesting to have him come in. But the point is that, you know, Kennan is here, and I should say the story, which is Bill saw the future with Apple because when Jobs and Wozniak walked into what was then Davis, Stafford, Kelman, and Fenwick in Palo Alto, which, of course, it's another story about I won't tell right now. Bill said, and everyone thought this was freaky. Mm-hmm. I think it's freaky because it's kind of become true. He said, you've got something that will eventually be a home entertainment device because Bill represented Pioneer Electronics. And his mind went to, you're going to pay for these electronic components to go in your house for high-end audio. This computer is going to sit in your house with the high-end audio and drive your home entertainment system. Mm-hmm. And I don't even think Jobs saw the fact that sound would play a role. And if you tell the story, have Bill listen to this part, because Bill really said, you know, this is really the future of an advanced home and an advanced audio system. And, you know, only really decades later did Apple come to realize that this thing is a great audio device, and it's probably done more for podcasting than almost anything else on the planet. And the information now gets out there really fast.
Yeah.
Even way faster than blogging, if you ask me, because people don't read blogs anymore. They want to listen to podcasts.
Yeah.
Well, they do. No, most of it is audio and visual, the video stuff we talked about. But, yeah, I mean, it was the radio show we started 11 years ago and podcasting now seven or eight years ago. And at the time, very few people were doing it.
And you probably haven't even gone back to the first 3 years of radio, terrestrial, you have to be clear, terrestrial radio, meaning free, on the dial, AM or FM, not XM radio, not, you know, the satellite radio. You have volumes of work that's not been converted to
podcast.
So you should dig up.
That's true.
And you should listen to what you were talking about 11 years ago. So you'd be like, wow, I was spot on. Or, man, was I wrong on that? Like, totally wrong about that.
Yeah, that's true. That the beauty I always say about podcasts or radio or when you record something is whether you're right or wrong, you're going to know it, or everybody else is going to know it.
Well, I'll tell you, people don't see this, but I'll predict you're going to see a whole future business of how funerals are held because they're becoming like multimedia events where people like go through, this is what so-and-so said on this day. Then he said this. It's like a review of someone's life. Now, they put it into sort of an interesting mode.
I haven't seen that yet.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're lucky. You haven't gone to as many funerals recently as I've gone to.
I would say that is lucky.
That's a lucky thing. No, because, Kennan, you know, you're in an area that I think could really take advantage of podcasting, which is how do you get the word out about science? And we're getting to the topic here because I pulled you at the last minute because I had another speaker, and the guy was like, I'm not sure if I can get down there. We've been doing this series about growing a company. we've also been looked at what are companies based on. They're based on people. They're often based on science and engineering. Okay. And you're at the very core root issue of how do you build a better scientist for better science, which then results hopefully in better citizens. Yeah. So I said, hey, could you come on? This is a last-minute thing. And you, great, this is the beauty of Silicon Valley. She said yes instantly and said, where do I have to be, when do I have to be there? And boom, you're here. Yep. And that really makes things happen. And I think that's the speed of trust and the speed of Silicon Valley that makes things go.
And it points to something else. I didn't know that about Bill seeing that the home computer would be the center of entertainment. I knew the pioneer angle for sure.
Yes.
But the other thing I did know was that he saw that it was individuation, that it put the power of what was the mainframe and the high priesthood of the computer engineer into the hands of the individual.
Right.
And that, I think, is also what we're talking about on the radio and the podcast and this ability. I'm a big believer in self-organizing systems.
Yes.
And large systems, especially if you want to go to scale, it's the individual rule set that drives how people find themselves within the system.
Yes.
And that's what you're talking about.
Right.
In terms of the home computer or the personal computer, it allows that. Podcasts, similarly, when you hear the information, you then get to act on it. So that is what creates a lean system. It creates sort of the self-decision mode.
Yes.
So I think that is the wave of the future.
Well, most people don't know, and I'll just spend a second explaining it. When you went to school in the 1950s and 60s, as I did, the computers were all mainframe. They were starting to become mini computers, but they took up a ginormous room that was essentially sealed by glass and air conditioning.
Right.
They still exist, mostly military installations. Mm-hmm. IBM still makes mainframes. It's probably still a pretty big part of their business. But to get access to those computers was like a ritual. You had to go to the high priest and say, hey, I need access, and I need this much time, and I need this much printer support. Stuff that kids that go to a coffee shop and turn on their laptops and have Wi-Fi and have a, maybe even a printer there. They're like, what? You have to ask someone? Are you crazy? You have to pay for the time. They had an accounting system behind it. So there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, and I think Jobs and Wozniak saw that, as did Bill, and said, that's going to change. Sort of similar to the way you see the real estate industry, which is a lot of fad, a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of slowness, or the way I see it in the legal industry, which is starting to pick up on electronic filings and do stuff that's a little more smooth, but can be a lot smoother than what it is, if you think about it. And so, yeah, we're seeing, we're in the midst of change. If we all live long enough, maybe we're going to really see this stuff really get ironed out. I mean, we're in the midst of a lot of turbulent change that's causing a lot of people to wonder, well, is it happening too fast? We might say it's happening too slow. You know, people in Silicon Valley want everything instantly. Yeah. Like, I think I'm the only one that witnesses daily people ordering their coffee at Starbucks online to pick it up so they don't have to wait online. Yeah. And I laugh at that and say, man, the whole notion of Starbucks was community. And they're like, no, I want to get in and get out. It's fast.
Well, why don't you do a proper introduction and get started and get specific, and I can't wait to hear about this topic we have here today.
Right. So I have with me a good friend. She's been driving a nonprofit effort that she's going to explain. Kennan's been doing work in this area for a while, and I think starting to get some traction. And the real question is, how do you break what I'll call the norms and reality of the bureaucracies that drive grants and university research and all the rest in a way that creates a more democratized system for creating new value in the form of experiments and research and science? And so you have a nonprofit that you're working through, right? So tell us the story, really, of how you even got to Silicon Valley, because I usually like to understand what your journey is, because you were not born in California, I don't think, if I'm remembering.
I actually was born in San Francisco, but I grew up in New Mexico.
New Mexico,
so
okay. I thought I remember
ways
that.
Around.
So tell us how like what happened, how you got from New Mexico here, maybe the right place to say.
It's a long journey. Well, I guess I'll only start after I had mostly grown up. So I did do college, undergraduate in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. I was pretty young. I was about 15 when I was heading off to college.
Wow, that's an accelerated deal.
When I was 16, it was 2 weeks after I turned 16 that I started.
So does that mean a lot of advanced placement classes kind of thing?
You know, I'm actually really happy, and it's a point of contention between me and some science teachers and AP classes, et cetera. I'm really glad that I I didn't take much science in high school because it wasn't taught well. Mm-hmm. And even Bruce Alberts has some of this same bias that I do, that it's much better to present the material when somebody is thought enough to ask the questions so that they're going in more as a question asker than somebody to receive all of the wisdom and answers that are already there.
Right.
Because that kind of flatlines it.
Brian Green,
Never thought about that.
Footnote this, Brian Green, a very famous and very youthful physicist and very well published, gave a lecture recently and said the problem for his kids now that he's recognizing is it's all about grades. And they're not just curious about the science, and they've kind of become, Dad, if it's not going to be on the exam, I don't want to review it with you.
Just prepare to score, right?
And
that's
pissed,
all it is.
And he's pissed, and he's like a senior person in Columbia University and thinks that's bad.
Yeah.
That's like we're forcing kids to be like rats responding to the cheese and not really responding to the curiosity of where's the maze lead and how do you get out of it. It's more like, hey, got to get the cheese, got to get the cheese, got to get the cheese. Doesn't matter if it's leading to a guillotine or not. You just got to get the cheese.
Kind of like the lemmings, right? On the cliff edge.
Yes.
Absolutely. And in fact, I will back up a little bit before I get myself from New Mexico all the way through back out to California, in that what you were saying about this change from bureaucracy, et cetera, in many sectors in real estate and in banking, and it's actually, I believe, happening in all the different sectors. We're at a moment in humanity and for humankind where we are going from what I call a kingship model, which is a very hierarchical model where you have different strata of society and different strata of power, power differentials, into something that's much more self-agency based. And I think this is a primary nexus for humankind to go through right now, because in agent-based decision-making in a more egalitarian society or equalitarian society, you have scalability, you have the ability to organize oneself around a much higher value metric, so such as keeping one's word and being a good citizen, as you say, which I also desire for scientists to be. But I think it's true in every sector that we're going through this change.
Well, some people talk about it as the fourth industrial revolution, but even that's misleading, because it's not really an industrial revolution. Like, if you think about the various industrial revolutions, you start with this view of, hey, we figured out how to have machines with steam. This is before electricity.
Right.
So we've got like a steam locomotive. Wow, we can burn coal. That's like the beginning of mechanization. Then there's a second industrial revolution with electricity. We can like start to power these machines with electricity, and you start seeing mass manufacturing, mass production of clothes, all this stuff happening. Then there's this third industrial revolution where computers come in, and the computers are just calculating machines, but they're doing it so fast that they enable stuff to happen. This fourth industrial revolution, but it's less industrial than it is kind of informational, is the machines start to understand and automate stuff that humans would do. And maybe you're really at the fifth revolution. The fourth is clearly happening with all this AI stuff. But the fifth becomes, how do you now have all of this intelligence that can be harnessed by decentralized workers or scientists or creators or whatever you want to call a knowledge person to actually build and create new value for a better society? And, you know, everyone's got a different view on whether that's going to happen in a way that, like, I don't think Amazon can get immediately recreated. I think that was a blip in time. I don't think one person could end up having that much wealth.
Yeah.
No, maybe someone will disprove that.
Well, that's a whole angle. I would say that there's a couple things that you pointed to. So one is the electricity and the steam engines, et cetera, is one of my favorite eras. And so the mid to late 1800s was the era of caissons and bridge building and steam engines, et cetera. And in some ways, we are catching up to that acceleration that we had around energy and power usage, right? Because it allowed power to be amplified, and so we could start building big structures, and then skyscrapers came within 50 years, and it accelerated our ability to impact our environment. But here we are. Our environment is hugely impacted. In fact, I would say that much of what we are in the face of, especially if you are paying attention, especially if you're in any of the areas around ecological systems or looking at large, major ecosystems, oceans, coral reefs, you realize we're going through radical, very fast change. So when you were talking earlier about, is it fast enough? Are we going too fast?
Yes.
Well, the environment's already going super fast.
Right, we're drawing it out.
Better keep up.
Yeah.
And so, yep, and so what we as humans have to do right now is the response mechanism to what was set in motion when we had that great capability of amplifying our efforts through the usage of carbon fuel sources,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I would say that this revolution is actually the humanization revolution, that we are getting to be more in touch with our human selves and how it is to be human and the quality of being here, existing on the face of the planet during our time here.
So
I think
you're an optimist. You're clearly an optimist. The glass is very full and brimming. Half full and brimming is the way people put it. Like, it's really half full, but it's brimming. You
but
see
it keeps getting tipped over. Yeah, I don't know about that part.
As a society as whole, I mean, certainly we see the younger generation seem to be more in tune.
They are.
But do you think also across the board, as a society, we're becoming more that way as well?
Yes. It's sporadic. It's episodic. But absolutely, there are large pockets of people. Mm-hmm. And certainly if you look at the movement around the ecosystems,
the Green New Deal,
Deal and Greta Thunberg, and that the youth of today, this mm-hmm. is their existential risk, and it's very real.
So it explains Bernie's success in some
absolutely
ways.
We need some radical
right?
We need freedom to be courageously authentic. That's a big deal right now. It's somehow we've gotten into these social mores where we live by rule sets where we self-regulate and mm-hmm. self-regulate in a hierarchical system. So things that need to be said aren't said. The quieter voices aren't heard. Mm-hmm. So we're not really empowering the full value of our system. And this is happening in science as well. So I'll go ahead and trace you a little bit through New Mexico.
Well, the fact that you accelerated, so you got out of high school really young.
Pretty young. Right? I mean, I skipped a grade and then I did high school in a couple of years and mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't too hard. It was New Mexico, and it was perfect, actually, I think, because I think you should grow up without all those pressures that we have on our students
mm-hmm,
today.
I agree.
It's crazy right now. It's really over the top, and it mm-hmm. wasn't done on purpose, but here we are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I graduated, and I was university studies major, actually, because I didn't know what I wanted to study. But I ended up, which I don't think is too typical, but I ended up with enough chemistry classes that I had a chemistry major by the time I graduated. And then I worked at Los Alamos Labs.
Okay.
And then I moved out here to California. I worked at Livermore Labs. And
okay.
And then I went off to graduate school.
Okay.
So I started and I got married. I met my late husband, Pete, at a scuba club conference.
Ah,
we met through scuba diving.
Okay.
I was an avid diver back then. And so UCSD was graduate school. And I was so out of the mainstream that I thought graduate school was a two-year program, which I'm really grateful for, because I don't know if I would have gone if I'd known how many years it really was.
Oh, you would have been like, forget it, I'm not doing that.
I don't know. I don't know, but thank goodness I was misinformed. So off to graduate school, and that was when you get kind of mainstreamed into if you love the research and you love the inquiry. And I'd already done inquiry at Los Alamos and Livermore, so I knew I really liked the hands-on, asking questions. Then you do a postdoc, and I really wanted to do research. And it was actually, I've had a few times in my life where I really had to look at, was I really a scientist? Was it worth what I needed to do to stay in science? And my postdoc was one of those times. Pete and I lived in Framingham. I'd had my daughter in graduate school. There was a rash of us female graduate students that had children. One did, and we looked at her and we go, oh, you can do that? And they even convened us. So, like, they had us all come together and meet
That's
in a room,
funny.
Like, what's up with you guys? What were you thinking, right?
Revolution.
So, Framingham, Massachusetts?
Mm-hmm, because it was halfway between Cambridge, where my husband got a job, and then I was at Worcester.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so I did my postdoc there.
Okay, and in the chemistry department, or what department?
It was biochemistry. So my area is biochemistry.
Okay.
Protein chemistry is what my PhD is in. And then I went into cell biology, and then later I went into genomics.
Okay.
So those are my three areas.
So are you looking at sort of the science of longevity as part of this? Because let me
tell
you,
the hot ticket right now.
It's a hot ticket, and I'll tell you, man, people are
pouring money.
And they just think, and of course, I am a big believer that if you can get your health span to last your lifespan, that's really the ticket. And if both end up getting to 100, man, you are so lucky. Mm-hmm. But to want to get to 120, or as my mom, who's 90, says, to get to 90 and not feel good, you'd rather have died. Like, that's the way she puts it.
Mm-hmm. That's
like,
how I
when
feel
you
about
get
it.
Up in yeah. pain, she doesn't want to do any of the heavy meds or mm-hmm. any of that stuff. And she said, man, try to have a long health span. So yeah, you shouldn't even be sense. Talking about lifespan. It's like, have a long health span and then mm-hmm. hope the lights go out
right.
fast. Because
right.
you don't want to be holed up in some hospice or, you know, under constant care.
Well, not
kind of
only
thing,
that
right?
quality of life. And
yes.
I'll give you my own analogy about yeah. science mm-hmm. regarding that. But there's also, I have to say, for myself, I think that there is an aspect of that inquiry and that desire to live longer that speaks to something being maybe a little off around trust in what happens after we die. Like, you can go any way you want with this. Like, you completely
yes.
disappear,
yes.
and maybe there's an ego in there about, oh, I don't want me, who I am, to disappear completely. But there are also all of, there's a lot of, most
good
people
point.
Have
mm-hmm.
beliefs in
right.
people that have passed on and, mm-hmm. And you know, souls, and that's of, I think, 60% or more, even of the scientific
have
populations,
some kind
either
of belief.
Spiritual or religious,
yeah.
right? So if you had more trust in that natural cycle, we might not be trying to stave mm. off
right.
death quite so vigorously. Mm. So that's one thing I believe. And I will say similarly, I had this realization a few years ago. For scientists, those who go into life science typically go in because they want to cure diseases.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at, and I know I have my own lens and my own environment that I've been in, it isn't the general truth, but it's generally fairly true
mm-hmm.
that most research communities are not actually that healthy themselves. It's sort of like the medical profession where doctors are really suffering from overstress and overwork, mm. et cetera, and often have very poor health parameters.
And
themselves.
Bad habits, yeah.
Yep. Stress,
mm-hmm.
you know, can mm-hmm. we say stress, right? And so mm-hmm. science is the same. And if you were really valuing the thing that you've committed and given your mm-hmm. life over to, which is to create health, think about two things here. One is, if you cure a disease, let's say nobody gets Lou Gehrig's disease anymore, mm-hmm. what have you brought that whole population to? You've brought them to a baseline of just a naturally healthy system, which they were born into,
right.
hopefully. Then there's the whole life to have on top of that. There's mm-hmm. the thriving to build. But you've only brought them up to ground zero. Mm. You actually haven't created anything. You've assuaged something.
Right.
And if you are all about the thriving mm-hmm. that would then allow, why aren't you thriving?
Right.
So I'm really looking at the core of what is the purpose of being a scientist and how are you looking at that as a whole system with you in it.
So that's like almost the philosophy of science at
Absolutely.
Some level, right?
There's a philosophy of science that is definitely underpinning our own work. And in fact, I found the philosopher that I really can get behind, Nicholas Maxwell in the UK. He has a book, From Knowledge to Wisdom, and I love his basic premises about
okay.
science.
So you've started a nonprofit. Am I remembering this right?
Yes, and so let me catch
yes.
you up.
Yes.
So I will just say, when I was a postdoc, it became apparent that our childcare, I became pregnant with my son Nick, and our childcare was more than my pay, and so we were having to pay for me to work.
Mm.
And that only could work for so long.
Yes.
And so we did the math, and it was actually when somebody came knocking on our door to start the repossession of our house.
That's
that we
terrible.
Were like, okay, we have to do something
really?
Different.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's terrible.
And at the time, I was in an area, protein chemistry, that was hugely popular. If you were at the large conferences, if there were lines for looking at jobs,
yes.
they would walk along the line. Any protein chemist? Any protein
really?
Chemist?
Yeah. Wow.
So in a heartbeat, because I trained with one of the top protein chemists,
yes.
I could have gotten a job.
Mm.
But
okay.
I didn't want to get a job. Out in industry. I really wanted to be a researcher. I really
okay.
wanted to be a professor.
Okay.
So I stayed in academia as a postdoc, and then I got a professorship at Georgetown University.
Okay.
And I guess I'll have a couple quick things to say about that. One was Janisix was the first female of an institution that was founded in 1789 as a boys' school, not as a university at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it had been in existence a long time, and mm-hmm. the chemistry department had not hired a single female until 4 years before I came in, and that was Janice.
Mm.
I was female number two. And it was a very arduous environment. It was a difficult environment. And
just in Washington, D.C.?
Yep,
right?
In Washington,
okay.
D.C.
What years were these?
I started
about?
In 93.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So it was the very sudden and unexpected mm-hmm. death of my husband in 99 before I'd gone up for tenure that was the thing that popped me out. Because that was not an environment for me to live in with our two young children.
Mm-hmm.
Nick was 8, Cassandra was 13, mm-hmm. and they just lost their father.
Yeah.
And the advice that I focus on tenure and then, you know, have somebody else pay attention to them was just untenable.
Right.
So that was a gift to get that advice. I had looked at setting up sort of my own sabbatical type of leave, and in what that led to was I actually had a job waiting for me on the phone that I hadn't even applied for at Celera Genomics, which was a wonderful 2 years when we did the human genome. I was a scientific specialist.
Nice.
I got to explain how this crazy chemistry worked. The whole genome shotgun actually worked. So that was super exciting. I then ended up, Celera moved me out to California, so now I've had a set to California.
Okay. Okay.
But I wanted to be here because I could see the kids and myself thriving in California. It's where their father and I had met. Mm-hmm. It's a very outdoorsy, focused environment and communities that
Plus
I lived
in. Plus, you were born
in
San Francisco, so you had to come back, right?
Maybe so.
Right?
I love
okay.
the hills over in Livermore area. When Celera stopped doing genomics work, I ended up at Berkeley, and I did a genome project at Joint Genome Institute. I finished a genome, I did the annotation of the genome, and I got to bring in the tools that we'd used at Celera. And what I realized, it's a form of AI, hidden Markov models, and I spent 4 years on this project, 2 years just myself in front of the computer doing extensive hands-on work for probably 10% of the genes. There's 4,000 proteins that are predicted in this particular life. So it's a life form that has a huge complexity, and I got to look at all of it through its DNA. I mean, it's a fantastic opportunity for a protein chemist. But what I realized is all of protein space is organized through these hidden Markov models from all the sequencing centers around the world.
Okay.
5 major sequencing centers. And it turns out, as a species, it would depend on which particular site actually had sequenced your genome as to what your proteins would be called. There was no
common
agreement,
vocabulary.
Right, for the really? Pipeline for annotation.
That's surprising.
Because I was using a single pipeline in my own hands that Kim and Scholander had helped me use her platform. She was done at Berkeley from Celera herself. Mm-hmm. I could see what the metatrends were. And I got on the bandwagon to go to NCBI and to NSF and to the senior scientists in the field and saying, you know, the sequencing centers, we need to be working together. We need to be using a common nomenclature and platform. Well, it turns out that the thing that was the block for that wasn't at all the technology. It was the humans.
Wow.
And that was one of the two reasons I started.
So politically, they're competing for grant money.
Absolutely.
Isn't that part of it? Like
that
I always thought
absolutely
people like to believe these places cooperate, and in theory they should, but there is sort of this competition for funding and
makes
for
sense.
Funding sources. So if they can have their own little trade secrets in what otherwise would be sort of, hey, we publish and we want to get the word out, the reality is they don't publish everything. They're like
the
selective.
Reality is that the competition is leading to very adverse outcomes.
Uh-huh.
And that has been recognized in a number of National Academy of Science reports. Wellcome Trust just came out with one last month about the culture of science, saying it's shocking.
Yes.
We're not getting our best outcomes. So there are a couple things I'll say about this. One is we are holding a retreat later this month at 1440 for a small group of scientists to do our Build a Better Scientist design.
1440 is a very special place.
What
a lot of people don't know about it. You might want to give them a little plug here, even though you don't get anything from them. You're like their customer, right? They actually offer facilities. They're trying to do stuff to get people together.
Yeah. Well, and they're one of the reasons that I love being in Silicon Valley, besides the fact that Bill's here, but the tech industry is actually very open-minded. Technologists and engineers are not the same as scientists. There's some pretty distinct divides between the two communities.
Yes.
And techie folk tend to be much more open to much wider thinking. Mm-hmm. This has a spiritual focus.
It
has a self-awareness focus, and that's also what I'm bringing into science.
Wow.
The time is
wonderful.
Right for that.
That's
and
good.
So it's a very good place for them.
Right.
It was created by the founder of Juniper Networks Systems and his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a focus around particular kinds of groups going there for a retreat experience.
Really?
Together. Yeah, so that's what we chose.
Where's it located? Is it near
Scotts
Woods?
Valley.
Scotts Valley.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
What's it called again?
1440 Multiversity.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Multiversity. So it's like university, but really with multiple disciplines.
Okay.
They have a catalog.
It's like a spiritual retreat type.
It's
a lot of things.
It's got science. It's got a science slant, I would say.
It has four different foci. Yeah. One of them is ecology, the environment. Mm-hmm. Another one is education.
Yes.
I think Parkinson's disease and then self-awareness.
Oh. So it's definitely more politically correct to go to something like that than it is to go to some sort of, you know.
That's like a Catholic or a Christian
What
I was thinking, and I can't remember the name, but there was a place that people would get into, and it was an all-male club. They would go into the woods and camp out.
There's a place up in
that.
You're not thinking about that place in the desert world.
No, that's Burning Man. No, that's the opposite end. That's for like the super liberals, but the super conservatives.
There is a place up at Bodega Marine area. I don't remember what it's called. I recently learned
that's
about
funny.
It.
Yes, and it's very, and it's sort of like very she to get invited.
Really?
You have to be vouched in. But
yeah, that is really old school, and it's definitely not what we would be. Yeah, one of the women. We just did a 3D design lab at Bodega Marine Labs in May last year.
Yes.
And one of the women, her daughter, was going to be working there in the summer. She was a bit concerned about that.
So you got to the point where you realized, hey, let's put some time into this nonprofit effort. What's the name of the nonprofit?
Yeah, it's Reimagine Science.
So Reimagine Science.
Right.
It's a good name.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
but
is
of course, you know, you're fighting the trend of sort of this.
There's
of,
a thirst,
right?
For
oh,
this,
still
though.
A thirst? Okay.
There, amongst scientists,
there is
a thirst. However, one of the biggest things against change in science is what I call the popcorn popper model.
Yes.
So you are either in science, especially if you're in academia, and you're inside the popcorn popper just trying to keep up with yourself.
Yes.
Or you pop completely outside, and you're way over here, and there's no interface for change.
Yes, I see.
So the popcorn popper model keeps everything in place.
Yes.
And it has been so entrenched for year after year, up to decade after decade.
Right.
We are still working on a policy that was made right after World War II.
Right.
And we haven't gotten the political will to change that. So we actually want to do a one could call it a witnessing, but a fishbowl, what I call, we do third space interactive dialogues that we've done over the years with postdocs and graduate students. But we are going to a next stage where we are going to have that population, which is suffering a lot right now, a lot, have them have what their life is like and what their concerns are, what they want to have witnessed, be witnessed in a fishbowl setting with the city leaders and with the policy leaders being able to see what's actually happening at the ground level with this policy that has been unable to be changed over so many years.
It's amazing to hear this because the perception, I guess, and this is shame on me and most people, you just automatically think that the speed of technology and how things are changing, evolution of all this stuff, that science is also that way. And what you're saying is you don't really understand what's going on with science, and there's maybe a paradigm change, or you're trying to
do
this. And it's just my perception, right? I guess maybe because we live here, we think everything's...
Well, when I was going to college, there was a famous guy who wrote, and I think he still is famous, named Karl Popper.
Absolutely.
Who in the philosophy of science said, look, we have to recognize that we don't really prove anything, we disprove.
Mm.
So you have to make some proposition to disprove. Don't expect to prove something.
Don't even expect
to prove gravity. Yes, we know gravity, and so far no one's disproved gravity. But I want to tie this gravity thing in because I think the connection I would instantly make for you is Brian Greene would be on your side. Dr. Brian Greene, Professor Brian Greene, you know, he's got a recent book out. He's pushing. He would probably be a speaker in your group because he's got strong views that are as yet not in any of his books, but I think he must be writing
out
a future book. But if you got him on your agenda for 1440, I would think you would fill the place up and get a bunch of people to make contributions towards your effort.
Yeah, right? Well, we're hoping for contributions because we're doing some key work. This is a design sprint with some key people, but we're just creating the scaffold for the launch of a learning journey that we are looking for, and we'll be pulling from exactly that kind of person.
Yes.
Our first cohort will be the thought leaders.
Yes.
They will be going through the learning journey themselves and then creating content.
Yes.
And it's modeled after AAAS's policy fellows. Drexel University has emerging leaders in academic medicine. There are many different training models out there that we've been tracking and in touch with over the years. This one is to train scientists not to go into another field, but to stay in science and have that kind of self-awareness training and have that kind of groupthink that comes from learning deeply together at that forefront of human knowledge right now.
So Jack is right. I think this is a perfect topic for you to start a podcast.
Well, not only a podcast.
I mean, how do you get your message out in this day and age, right?
Yes.
I mean, you're doing a wonderful job with the events and different things, right?
Yes.
But this is truly the way to get the message out as quickly as you can and efficiently as you can, and you start growing an audience that could follow, communicate, connect with you.
Well, here's another speaker that would have a lot of interesting views to say. So a gentleman I know, really great guy, Dr. Leonard Hayflick. Dr. Hayflick was the discoverer of the Hayflick limit. The Hayflick limit says that really cells eventually have to die. Now maybe they can, you know, new ones come in their place, but eventually there's death, and pretty much the laws of physics will dictate death more than the laws of biology or chemistry, to get back to the longevity thing. And he's got, and I'll send to you his most recent letter on this, 93, he's still writing letters to various scientific journals, saying science is not focused on the right issues concerning lifespan and health span. And he goes through this in some detail. So if you were to bring him to a topic like your current one that you're planning for April or May, when is it happening?
We'll be launching the learning journey. March is when we're doing the retreat.
Oh,
March 20th
to
22nd.
Yep, 1440. Yeah. So, I mean, let's say you could get a bit of his time. Now, he lives up north in, you know, 2-3 hours away, but conceptually, he still drives, you know, he still is like 93, going strong. He, in 20 minutes, I think, would say a lot of what is not right in the area of biology from the philosophy of science point of view. And there's a guy that's been doing science for like 70 plus years.
Wow.
I mean, literally, from graduation to PhD to everything else.
And he's
got
in that messy middle, too, because he was doing the altruistic basic research, and then there's this other end around IP protection.
Yes, exactly.
We've got this messy middle that's not done well at all now.
And so, you know, I could see him and a few others coming in to say, you know, things have to change and they have to improve, and the faster it happens, the
better.
I think
everybody feels it. Yeah. I will say the other thing that we use as a platform is TED and TEDx.
Wonderful. That's great. I love TEDx.
And so we're actually proposing, and have been working, using the TEDx evaluation of whether something is scientifically valid or not as a sandbox for looking at how we judge where truth is in science. So that's an area
that's
very active.
So they have
a
little checklist? Is that what they do?
No, I'd like to help them create a process.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we have just a couple more minutes. So I want to make sure that we get as much information as we can here out to our listeners. Yeah. So how would we kind of round this up and wrap it up in terms of the message? And then is there anything that the listeners could potentially help you with, too, or support with, or more that they need to know?
Send money.
Yes,
just
but we do need resources. So there is, and I just had a talk with Wellcome Trust yesterday, and I was saying one thing that the foundations are having a very hard time doing is to identify the new ideas, the new social entrepreneurs. So social entrepreneurs are what I call paid for from the future.
Mm-hmm.
They're not being paid right now because there are not boxes for what they're doing, but they're all working on the future.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm no different, and so actually resources are a major thing because we've got more money. I had a conversation with Bruce Alberts a few years ago. I said, and he's like, oh, how are we going to change these things, the problems? I said, okay, look, we have more money than we've ever had on the planet.
Yeah.
We have more people than we've ever had on the planet. Actually, I have this backwards. We have more money. We have more problems. Thank goodness we have more people than ever.
Mm.
Right? All you have to do is get those all working together well. And we've got
It's a distribution or redistribution.
We've got all these people to work on the problems.
Yeah.
So
where would,
all these people to work on
that
the
is,
problems.
That's a good point. So where would people go to a website information
so
to find out more?
Reimagine.
Okay.
Reimagine.
Reimagine.
R-E-I-M-A. G-I-N-E, science.org.
And then what I would ask also for anybody listening is, what is your relationship to science? So especially if this is real estate agents, I'm in some local, I'm on the East Bay Economic Development Alliance.
Oh,
I've been on the Tri-Valley Leadership Group. So I'm in those local regionalism economies.
Right.
And that quality of life for a community, that the whole fabric of how we live together as humans, science has a part in that, and science has a part for each of us individually. And so my inquiry would be, what is a person's individual relationship with science, and what would you like it to be? What would you like science to provide for you and for the community, and where do you already see it playing? Because science really is at the basis of our industrialized, mechanized, electronified society right
Some
now.
Some people don't realize it, but you know, but for the early science dealing with the creation of a microprocessor, we wouldn't have Silicon Valley today.
Right.
I mean, that's at the very beginning and core.
Absolutely.
Remind people of your full name, too, again, when they go to the website, so they know who they're listening to.
It's Kennan, K-E-N-N-A-N. Lots of N's.
Salerno?
Salinero. S-A-L-I-N-E-R-O.
Right, very Italiano name. Is your husband Italian? Your ex-husband Italian?
He was Spanish.
Spanish, okay.
Okay.
But conceptually, you're doing something that makes me think that maybe tying to even terrestrial radio, like Science Friday on 88.5, getting on KQED, the station that runs
Science Friday.
And it seems like this is at the core of what could even be a series on Science Friday on the philosophy of science. Because I don't think that when I say to people, there's a guy named Karl Popper's life, like, what? Karl Popper? Who? Disprove? Like, they have no friggin' idea.
Maxwell studied with him.
It's a very big part of becoming someone who questions as opposed to someone who just simply asserts. And oftentimes I say to people, and you'll often see it in any of the tweets I do, I just pose the question. I don't try to argue. I don't try to do. I just try to really objectively state the question. And, you know, a lot of law is very much about giving the judge or the jury the question. Because, you know, if they have the question and they could see that you're asking the right question, that's like half the battle.
So instead of trying to change their mind or argue something, here's the question.
Sometimes if you have the ability to just pose the question. It almost answers itself, or it enables one to go on the right path to getting an answer. Someone who argues or asserts or sort of becomes overzealous, people are like, you're not giving me the roadmap. I've got to get there by myself.
So I have to say, that's what I call porous. And we're living, I am in two different kinds of communities. One is a closed community where predictive analysis, et cetera, can work very well. RAND has huge data sets. Anything that's a mature industry is a closed system, and most of the science conferences tend to be that way. The open system is a much more self-regulated, self-organizing system that's very porous, and it works on the basis of questions.
Yes.
It's a two-way stream. It's a co-creation.
Yes.
The two have different flavors. They have a different feeling in the room when you walk in the room. So I love that you ended with that. The question is a perfect ending.
Well, good luck in later this March, and maybe we'll have you on after you get this thing sort of
Because we'll be launching it. The thing that we'll be doing after this is launching that learning
cohort. Yeah, we'll have you back.
And that's where people will want to be interested, because they can be part of that learning cohort.
So you should think about maybe getting permission to record and then selectively create podcasts out of select portions of whatever you do. I know people will be worried, well, then maybe I can't say
No, that's part of our design.
You're gonna
do that. Presencing Institute, ULab, we've been a ULab hub for a number of years, so it's absolutely part of the design.
Perfect.
Brilliant.
Well, thanks for coming on.
Yeah,
thanks,
thank
Joe,
you very
for
much.
Having us.
My pleasure. Jack, real quick, remind everybody what
Jack
you do.
Jack Russo, managing partner of Computer Law Group in San Francisco and Palo Alto, 650-327-9800, jrusso, J-R-U-S-S-O, at computerlaw.com. And we see entrepreneurs all the time that are doing basic science, and they're like, hey, I want to create a business out of it. And oftentimes the science is not quite far enough along. And you see, and you wish them well, and you say, you know, maybe come back in a few years. And sometimes they do come back. I mean, look, you know, the electric car failed the first time around.
Yeah.
It's immensely succeeding 30 years later.
Mm-hmm. But the other thing I know about you is you are a great champion for people that need that kind of legal protection.
Thank you very much. Yes,
that's
I learned it early in life, and I'll give credit to Bill Fenwick, because he was a mentor, and we did a lot of great cases together throughout the United States. And certainly I learned a lot from Bill, and I guess Bill's going to have a birthday coming soon, or am I misremembering? August, right? Okay, good. Look forward
when
to that party.
Get him on the show.
I don't know. I got I think I'm halfway there. Now Kenan goes back and says, "Hey, it's a great place. Come on board." Yeah, Bill, if you're listening, if you've gone this far and listened, and I hope you do.
Here's your
you're
testimony
welcome to come
now.
On the show.
So go back with your
In fact,
testimony.
I'd love to have all of the. I'd love to have Davis, Stafford, Kelman, Fenwick, and there were even a few other people that they lost their names in the story, but I would like to find all of those co-founders. It would be a great story to have them all come on.
Great
Good.
Show.
Thanks very much.
Yeah,
thanks,
thank
Joe.
You very much. Sure. Thanks again for tuning in. This is Joe Cuchero with Real Estate Radio Live. Thanks again. Take care. Have a great afternoon.
You've been listening to Real Estate Radio Live. For more information on today's program, visit reradiolive.com. That's reradiolive.com. Subscribe to our podcast. Discover more at reradiolive.com.